John Cohen from Science Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Larry. Glad to be here.
So let's start with today. Last couple days, including today, we've been hearing a lot about when to treat. New guidelines from IAS USA about when to treat and you know, some of the advantages of treating early. What's going on here?
It's a funny thing that here we are in 2008, and even in wealthy countries, there's no clear idea about when the best time to start someone on treatment is. In poor countries, there are guidelines that say from the World Health Organization, start people when their CD4 cells drop to 200 or below. A normal person has, let's say, 600 to 1200, and on average you lose about 50 a year when you're infected. There are new guidelines from the IAS suggesting you should start people sooner when they're at 350 or below. The evidence shows that when you start people at 350, they live longer, they do better. It makes a lot of sense. And in many poor countries, when you have a cutoff of 200, it doesn't mean that people show up at 199. They'll show up when they get sick with 50 CD4 cells left. And there's abundant evidence that they don't fare as well. They don't respond as well to the drugs. They don't live as long. So the equation is, well, you want, of course, people to live as long as possible, to respond to the drugs. But when you're treating millions of people and you raise the bar there to 350, as an AIDS activist, Greg Gonzalez, said today, this could wreak havoc on these healthcare systems that are already struggling to keep up with that 200 cutoff.
Hey, there's actually been a lot of talk today as well about the relationship between the HIV epidemic and health systems in countries being overburdened. You know, and you hear two things. I mean, that AIDS has put a burden on these health systems, but is also the funding going to the epidemic has also helped improve the systems.
Yeah, I think that today once again the healthcare system argument clearly tilts toward people here arguing that AIDS funding is building healthcare systems. And to wait for healthcare systems to be ready to handle HIV is unconscionable. You know, that's the other side of the coin. What? Everybody's supposed to sit around and say, well, everything's not perfect. And the way that people have gone into this is, we've got to throw everything at this because it's a war. The people dying. We've got to save them. So I don't think here in this huge conference hall there are very many people who feel like AIDS is harming healthcare systems.
What about the financial implications? I mean, already we have millions of people not getting access to drugs. If you change these guidelines and say that more people should be getting them, it's going to cost more, right?
It is going to cost more, and there was no real hard number sort of discussion about that today, but there is an awareness that it will cost more. You know, everything in this field, it's so new sometimes when the ideas come forward. People don't have time to really cost things out and plan it the way you might plan a business. They're trying to keep people alive.
Has the nature of the debate over funding changed a bit? I mean, in the beginning, it was really almost a crisis emergency mentality. Now there seems to be a realization that if you're going to put people on treatment and the treatment works, they're going to be on it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and there's also a greater realization about it has changed because it's not about crisis, it's about sustainability. You know, how are we going to do this for years and years on end? There's a lot of talk today about sustainability. And one of the main issues with sustaining the response is people who go on to cocktails of drugs are at some point going to need to switch. For the first 2 million people who went on to antiretroviral drugs in this massive rollout that's occurred, the World Health Organization calculates that 97% of them are on first-line treatment, which is much, much cheaper, maybe tenfold cheaper than second-line treatment.
These are often generics, the first-line drugs now?
Generics, yeah. So there's, you know, a tenfold difference. That's a lot of money. Well, Brazil, which started universal access in 1996, and there was a woman here from Brazil who presented today about this, 25% of their people, 190,000 treated people, 25% are now on second-line treatment. And it's hurting Brazil, and Brazil's worried about how much money they're spending on the drugs.
So are we going to start to see a return to some of the intellectual property patent rights we
That issue is that came up again today, and Alan Tajon from Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, was discussing this. The patent issue has, you know, always been at the center of this debate. But there's been one other thing at the center of this debate, and it's been India. India wasn't constrained by patent issues because it had it was outside of the World Trade Organization rules until 2005. So now India is going to be forced to observe the same patents that everyone else is. And as Ellen Tajon was saying, you know, don't kid yourselves. If we don't have the ability for India to make generics, we don't have a bargaining tool with Big Pharma for them to lower their prices for the drugs that they're making. And that changes the whole equation.
Well, speaking of India, there was also some talk today of India's prevention initiative, Avahan, and some of the successes.
Yeah, oh, everyday people have been talking about Avahan at the meeting. Now, Avahan is a massive prevention campaign, very well funded, and they run it like a business. And so they did some cost analysis comparisons of what Avahan can do versus others, and they do it much more cheaply. And as one researcher said, you know, McDonald's counts how many hamburgers they sell, and Avahan counts how many people they're treating and actually follows up and really does a good job of it. And the sentiment here that's coming out is public health specialists have been running all this, and they don't know much about business and doing things on a grand scale. And we have to start thinking more in that business mentality of accountability and monitoring and changing things when they aren't working.
Well, changing topics a little bit, back to more geeky science, which I know you like to talk about. Some talk about a new technique to identify highly infectious people, people very early on in the stage of infection. And if we can identify them, then we can potentially help stop some of the spread of the disease.
Yeah, we know from several studies that in the first few months after someone gets infected, their immune system hasn't really fully kicked in. The virus is high. They are highly infectious people. They infect. In one study, they infected 44% of the people in the study. And, you know, when you think about the fact that people live for 10, 12 years with HIV, that's a huge proportion of infection happening in the first few months. So what if you could identify those people? They don't have HIV antibodies. Their immune system hasn't even made antibodies. So they're not even going to be picked up in normal screening. Well, one way to do it is to use a very sensitive test that looks for HIV genetic material, for the RNA. And it's an expensive test. You can't do it on 1,000 people. So what they've done is they've pooled the blood of 1,000 people. And bear with me, it's a little technical. They pool the blood of 1,000 people. They have 1,000 test tubes. And then they line up 10 test tubes. And they put drops of 100 people into test tube 1, drops of the next 100 in test tube 2. And then they do that DNA RNA test on the 10 test tubes. Let's say 9 of the test tubes are all negative. You throw them away. Now you've got one test tube with 100 people in it. You know who they are because you've got those other test tubes back here. You take 10 more test tubes, you make 10 test tubes of 10, and you test those 10, throw away 9 of those. You've got 10 people left. You can find the one, maybe even two people, who are in that stage of what's called acute infection. So they've just presented a study here today about doing this in Malawi and South Africa, you know, in developing countries. And they did it primarily in sexually transmitted infection clinics. And they found that 1.1% of the people that they screened this way were acutely infected. You know, that's a lot of people. And then they contacted their partners if they could and tried to bring them into the study. And they're going to follow up and study these people. But I think it's a very clever prevention strategy that's outside of the realm of what most people are thinking about when they think prevention. And that's precisely what's needed, because in this new world of cocktail prevention, you know, where more is more, that's more.
Well, this is our last report here from Mexico City. You know, looking back on the week, what issue really resonated most this week, do you think?
Well, as I anticipated in the beginning, it was prevention, 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 you know. And it was the marriage of treatment and prevention. You know, as one researcher said, they've been at the altar a long time. Let's get them married. And they got married this week. There was a ceremony. They were married. And, you know, and everybody finally realizes that when activists now go in the street, they're not simply going to be chanting treatment now. They're going to be chanting treatment and prevention now, because we know that treated people are less likely to spread. And that's prevention. And, you know, the prevention people also realize that they are linked to the treatment people in ways like we discussed yesterday, this idea of pre-exposure prophylaxis, uninfected people taking drugs to prevent infection. You know, that's a very promising research study right now. Well, what is it? Is it treatment? Is it prevention? It's both. And that's the new way of thinking, and that's what really came to front and center this week.
And looking ahead to Vienna, do you expect sort of more research, more effort going into that marriage, into these kind of joint treatment and prevention strategies?
There weren't a lot of answers here, you know, to be frank.
You started to ask the questions.
Yeah, and the data are going to come in between now and then. We're going to know whether many of these ideas that were discussed here actually work or actually fail. And, you know, this conference, as opposed to, this is the 12th one I've been to, it had fewer presentations that actually had results, you know, and where people could say, hey, we did this big study and we learned this big finding. It's not what this conference was. But the next one, well, could be.
Well, assuming you're back there for the 13th, we'll see you.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Okay, thanks, John.